Well, good morning. If you would grab a Bible, we're going to be in Matthew chapter 14 for this part of our worship this morning, Matthew 14. Thank you to Chris for his kind words. I am excited to be here again. I mentioned, as Chris mentioned, a few years ago we were here, and I mentioned then, I would be remiss not to mention again, what a special place this congregation has in our hearts for both me and my wife, my kids. Well, it was a little before their time, but when I first started preaching the gospel, I accepted the work in a little town called Grand Saline, which probably most of you know where that is, and the elders here were willing to help us with supporting us as we began a new work, and I was an extremely green preacher, and they took a chance on us, and I have just always been so thankful for the fellowship of this congregation and the good work that you guys have enabled us to do by your support and your help. So thank you again for what you've done. I know probably many of you weren't here in that time, but I'm thankful for that. I saw Brother Jimmy Dietzel this morning. Brother Jimmy came over and filled in while I was trying to get my feet under me and helped us out. Just a wonderful way this church blessed that group and us in particular. Thank you for being here. Looking forward to the week. I'll have some more things to say about what we're going to do in terms of the lessons throughout the week a little later in the worship hour. But I want to start just by reading here Matthew 14 and verse 1. It says, "At that time Herod the Tetrarch heard about the fame of Jesus, and he said to his servants, 'This is John the Baptist. He has been raised from the dead. That is why these miraculous powers are at work in him.'" This is a section that really focuses on how Jesus has become famous and how his fame creates problems for him. So here, Herod hears about Jesus, and immediately Herod senses that there is a problem, and his problem, his conclusion, is that this is John the Baptist who I killed, and now he's been raised from the dead, and now he has special powers. So it's going to lead to all kinds of problems for Jesus, to have crowds that keep following him everywhere he goes. It's going to lead to problems with the government. It's going to lead to problems with the Pharisees. His fame becomes so much that people begin to notice him in a bad way. But what Matthew 14 is a story of one really long day in the life of Jesus. And I just want us to take some time in this hour to look through this chapter, because we all know what it is to have a long day, and we all know what it is to deal with difficult people, and we all know what it is to have demands on our time and attention, and we all know what it is to receive bad news. We all know what it is to have a long day. But I think that we can find some things here from how Jesus manages his day that will help you and me to figure out how we get through our days. So we're going to call this How Jesus Got Through the Day. And as we do that, my goal, we're headed somewhere. We're going to study what Jesus did and how he managed this. And then we're going to talk about how you and I can get through our days, our long days, our good days, our bad days, in the ways Jesus did. So we're going to start by just looking at this first little section, which is about bad news. Let's read beginning in verse 1. The text says, "At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard about the fame of Jesus, and he said to his servants, 'This is John the Baptist. He has been raised from the dead. That is why these miraculous powers are at work in him.'" So Herod assumes that Jesus must be John, who has been raised from the dead. Now, that is not a typical reaction, right? When you hear about somebody getting famous, you immediately say, "Oh, that's that guy I killed, and he's raised from the dead, and now he has special powers." John the Baptist did not do miracles, and yet he says now John must be doing miracles. He is doing great works, which, by the way, is the same words that at the end of chapter 13, the people of Nazareth are so upset because they don't understand how Jesus has these great powers or these mighty works. So he is shocked to see them in Jesus just as the people are. But what this indicates is that Herod has a guilty conscience. He feels bad. He did something he knows he shouldn't have done. He hurt a man of God, and now he is saying, "This must be my evil deed come back to haunt me." So then Matthew proceeds to tell us the story of Herod's mistake. Verse 3, "For Herod had seized John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John had been saying to him, 'It's not lawful for you to have her.' And though he wanted to put him to death, he feared the people because they held him to be a prophet." So Matthew tells the story of John's death. It starts with John critiquing Herod for the immorality of him stealing his brother's wife. Now, I think it's a little hard for us to get our minds around this, because we live in a nation where we have the ability to speak freely, And so it is very rare for someone to say something, especially publicly critical of some official, and then be arrested for saying that. But that's what happens to John. John criticizes the wrong man. And so it gets him arrested, but there is this sort of limbo that John stays in. Because Herod and Herodias don't want him saying this, they arrest him, but they fear the people. So they're a little intimidated to actually put him to death. And so John is in limbo in prison, waiting on, well, what's going to happen? Is he going to be released? Which way is the shoe going to drop? We also get a little insight into Herod's inner life. In verse 5, it says, though he wanted to put him to death, he feared the people because they held him to be a prophet. So something is going to have to happen for Herod to tip one way or the other and overrule this sort of limbo situation. So verse 6, but when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before the company and pleased Herod, so that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she might ask. Prompted by her mother, she said, give me the head of John the Baptist here on a platter. So this is Herod's stepdaughter, Herodias' daughter, and she comes and dances in front of him and all his guests during this big party. And he is so impressed by this that he makes a foolish oath. I'll give you whatever you want. Mark's account says, up to half my kingdom. Which, by the way, is a colossally dumb thing to say, right? Because she could have asked for anything. What if she asked for half the kingdom? Okay. Instead, she sees an opportunity, but she doesn't really know what to do. She goes to her mom, and her mom says, I know exactly what you should ask for. Ask for the head of John the Baptist on a platter. So she is seizing the opportunity to finally get rid of John, and she says, just like you're bringing out all these dishes at this great banquet, bring out John the Baptist's head. And so Herod reluctantly agrees. Verse 9, the king was sorry, but because of his oaths and his guests, he commanded it to be given. He sent and had John beheaded in the prison, and his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. So he regrets it, but, I mean, he feels he's between a rock and a hard place. He's bound to keep his oath in front of everybody, and so he ends up killing a good man. Verse 12, and his disciples came and took the body and buried it, and they went and told Jesus. This is a sad story. We talk a lot about Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. And we talk a lot about the great deliverances you read about in the Bible. Daniel and the lion's den. Seems to me we don't give as much press to someone like John the Baptist. A time when God could have delivered and did not. A time when a good man is simply put to death for no good reason except the weakness of a ruler and his foolish oath. It is sad. So what do you think? When Jesus gets that news, it says there in verse 12, his disciples came and took the body and buried it, and they went and told Jesus. John and Jesus are very close. They are relatives. The specific nature of the relationship isn't really detailed in Scripture, but they're close relatives. Many of John's disciples become Jesus' disciples. In fact, their messages, John and Jesus' messages, are so closely related that Herod can't tell them apart. In fact, it's so closely related that people have no problem going from John to Jesus. Jesus and John are close. And so when Jesus gets this bad news, it upsets him. And he has a reaction to it that we're going to see in the text. But I just want to remind you, if we're talking about what it would be like to live through a day like this, just think about that news coming to you. Someone close to you, important to you, brave, courageous, prophetic, stands up for what's right, says it's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife, gets thrown in prison, and now is unceremoniously beheaded. And you get the news. How does it make you feel? Well, that's not the only thing that happens in this day. We're going to move forward to some hungry crowds. Look in verse 13 with me. It says, now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. But when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. So after getting the bad news, Jesus tries to get away from everybody. He goes in a boat all by himself to a desolate place. But word gets around that he's sailing, and so they say, oh, let's go over there and meet where he's going, and we'll go see him there. So that when he gets to the place, there is already a crowd gathered there, so he can't be alone, even though he is seeking to be alone. Verse 14, when he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. So the text says Jesus had compassion, and this is a beautifully vivid term. It means actually to be deeply moved in the stomach. We would say something like your heart was stirred within you. So Jesus has a reaction to seeing these people. He says, this is something that I care about. I'm upset. I see all the need and it stirs me up. You just think about that crowd. Some of these people have brought their sick relatives around the rim of the Sea of Galilee, trying to follow. Where's he going to be? Where's he going to be? We've got to get to Jesus. Or maybe some of them are limping there because they have an illness or they are lame. Maybe they've come just to hear a new teaching or a new parable. You know, chapter 13 of Matthew is just full of parables. All these interesting stories where Jesus says, this is what the kingdom is like. So they say, well, I wonder what new thing he's going to say. I wonder if maybe we can ask him about some of those things I didn't understand that he said before. But what Jesus sees is that there is a group of people who are seeking to draw nearer to God. And when he sees that, his heart goes out to them. And so it says in verse 14 that he heals their sick. You ever wonder how the Bible can say so much in just a couple of words? Have you thought about what it would look like? I wonder if they made a line or if it was just a free-for-all. You know, whoever's closest gets healed first. You know, there are some people who are, oh, can I touch him? Maybe if I just touch the hem of his garment. Well, then you want to get in the front of the line. You want to sneak around. I wonder if Jesus said, tell me about your story. Sometimes Jesus will ask people, how long has this been happening? And they'll tell, well, I've been suffering for 12 years. I've been suffering for 17 years. On and on it can go. Sometimes Jesus just knows their story. Like the woman who is bent over and he says for 13 years she's been bound by Satan. But I wonder, because that would be an incredible thing, just to sit there and listen to story after story of the infirmities of man and watch Jesus heal. So he heals their sick. But just imagine, person after person, hour after hour, the whole day, this is what Jesus does. Verse 15. Now, when it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place, and the day now is over. Send the crowds away to go into the villages to buy food for themselves. So here's the difficulty, right? Now we're at the end of the day, and nobody has eaten all day, and we're in the wilderness, a long way from civilization. So the disciples say, Jesus, that's about enough. The disciples often like to manage Jesus a little bit, and manage the ministry, you know, get those kids out of here. No, we don't have time for that. But here they say, Jesus, this is enough. You need to send them away or else they're going to faint on the way trying to get food. I wonder if they're not just concerned about the people, but also a little concerned about Jesus and his stamina. Verse 16, but Jesus said to them, they do not need to go away. You give them something to eat. They said to him, we have only 5 loaves here and 2 fish. And he said, bring them here to me. Then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass, and taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing. Then he broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. And they all ate and were satisfied, and they took up 12 baskets full of the broken pieces left over, and those who ate were about 5,000 men besides women and children. I love that Jesus says they don't need to go home, and then he says to the disciples, you give them something to eat. In fact, John's account says he said this to Philip, specifically to test him. Because there is something about you having to sit with a problem that helps you see how big the problem is. You know, Jesus, if you just see Jesus, he feeds 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish, you say, oh, that's a cool story. But have you ever tried to feed 5,000 people? Or have you ever said, you know, man, we just need to get some food to at least get the process started. Anybody got food for 100? You guys, anybody? Anybody bring any? Huh, all we got is 5 loaves. And so when they sit with the problem and they say, well, we tried and tried and all we got is 5 loaves and 2 fish. Now all of a sudden they say, this is a big deal. So Jesus puts the problem on them and then he takes the problem on himself. He thanks God for the food, it says in verse 19. And then he breaks the loaves and he gives to the disciples. And the way the text reads, he just keeps giving and giving and giving. I'm not sure the crowds knew where the bread was coming from, but the disciples knew because they knew they didn't bring it to him and there was no bread. And so they began to understand. There is more food after the meal than before it. That never, ever happens. So, we're still in Jesus' long day. After this bad news, Jesus is confronted by even more need. It is a tidal wave of need. So much need. Overwhelming need. There are sick people. There are hungry people. There are ignorant people. There are disciples who don't understand and need to be taught and matured and brought along. Jesus just keeps responding to the need. He just keeps caring. He just keeps healing. He just keeps teaching all day long. And when there is an opportunity to end things, he says, nope, we're not ending it. You don't need to send them home. You need to give them something to eat. He makes more food and he extends the day even further. The third thing I want you to see is this next section where we talk about water walking. Water walking. Look in verse 22 with me. It says, immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. So after dinner, he sent the disciples away. He wants them to go to the other side. He says, I'll come over there later. Then he himself dismisses the crowds. Verse 23. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. So Jesus goes up onto the mountain to pray long into the night. But when he finishes, the boat is a long way from land, and it's too far out for them to come and pick him up. But they're also trying to sail into the wind, and so sailing doesn't seem like a great option. But the thing about the Sea of Galilee, I put a picture of the Sea of Galilee up on the board. The Sea of Galilee is not terribly wide. And depending on where you are and where you're going to, usually something like 8 miles wide. And so Jesus decides, well, maybe he can even see them out in the middle of the lake there, not getting anywhere. He decides he will just walk. Verse 25. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, it is a ghost. And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them saying, take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid. So it's 3 a.m. now. If you're keeping track of the day, we spent all day healing people, feeding people. Jesus has now prayed. Now it's 3 a.m. and he comes to them walking on the water. Mark says he was going to just walk by them, which gives you an indicator of how slow they were going. He could walk faster than they could sail. But he was just going to walk by them until they notice him. And of course, they are terrified. They think it must be a ghost. Jesus says, calm down. You know it's me. All right. Verse 28. And Peter answered him, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. He said, come. So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. Peter asked Jesus, if you look in verse 28 carefully, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. I love that phrasing because Peter is assuming if you command me to do it, then you're going to enable me to do it. That what God commands us to do, he equips us to do. There's a principle there. That'll preach, Chris, wherever you went. What God commands us to do, he equips us to do. And so he says, command me to do it, and I know I'll be able to. And so he says, come to me, and Peter walks out on the water. Now, this is an amazing thing. Just imagine what it is to be Peter. Got the wind ruffling your hair, and you're standing on the water, and so you probably feel it move a little bit, but it doesn't give. And you begin to walk. You look back at the boat, what do you see? You see a lot of open mouths from all the disciples that are still there. But something changes in Peter, verse 30. When he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshipped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. The text says that when he saw the wind, which the wind is not really something you see, but I think the idea is he saw the way the wind was whipping up the waves. Peter gets scared and he begins to sink and he cries out, Lord, save me, in a panic. And so Jesus reaches out. But I love this because that's not the end of it for Jesus. Jesus says to Peter, Peter still needs to learn something from this. And so he says to Peter, oh, you of little faith. Why did you doubt? So he says, Peter, think deeply about that moment that just passed. What just happened? why did you react the way you did? Why did this happen like this? What were you thinking? By the time they land, there are more healings to be done. Look at verse 35 and 36. The whole new day has started, and yet there are more people there, and there are more sick people. He begins to heal again. So the day continues, and Jesus keeps teaching and healing and giving and serving. That's a long day. In fact, I can't even say that it ends, because on we are to the next day. So what can we learn from that? I know that's neat, interesting. You know, Matthew 14 is a cool chapter, but I don't want to leave it there. I want us to think about how Jesus got through the day. Jesus was a man like you and me. He had days. He had hard days. He had long days. He had exhausting days. But I think we have some clues in the text for how Jesus handled a day like this. If you and I had a day like this, I'll just say it this way. If I had a day like this, it might be years before I quit complaining about that one day. All the things I had to do, all the cool things that happened, all the disappointing things that happened, the bad news, you know, what Peter did, all of that. Complaining, because hard days are something I tend to complain about. But Jesus doesn't. Jesus doesn't seem to resent the toll this takes on him. Instead, I want you to see how Jesus gets through the day. Look back in verse 12 with me. In Matthew 14 and verse 12, it says, his disciples came, this is John's disciples, and took the body and buried it, and they went and told Jesus. Now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. But when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. So I want you to notice, when he gets the bad news about John, what does he do? He withdraws. He goes to a desolate place by himself. Jesus wants to be away from people. And I believe the strong implication, particularly with what we're going to see in a moment, is that Jesus wants to be in prayer. He needs to go pray, and to pray the way he wants to pray, he needs to be away from people. Of course, the crowds don't let him do it at this time. But I also want to consider that Jesus might not just be mourning John. It might not just be that he got bad news. Because with that bad news about John, there is something else that has to be triggered in Jesus' mind. And this is something a little later in Matthew. This is Matthew 17 and verse 12, where John the Baptist is described as Elijah by Jesus, the fulfillment of the Elijah prophecy. And it says, the Elijah prophecy in Malachi, but I tell you that Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they pleased. So also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. Jesus knows that what they did to John the Baptist is just the beginning, and they are coming for me too. It is one thing to get bad news about some awful thing that happens to someone we love. It's another thing to say, the same people that did it to them are coming for me. I know it. Jesus knew it. And so it may be that even at this time, the bad news of John just speaks to the looming spectacle of the cross. It's just a reminder, don't forget, Jesus, this is why you're here. This is where you're headed. And so when he gets that news, Jesus wants to pray. But he's interrupted. His prayer retreat is broken up by a whole bunch of people who are there needing him. And so instead of grieving and praying, instead of thinking about his mission and what is going to happen when someday he himself is killed, he has to serve and heal and teach. And he does. Surrounded by need, he responds with compassion rather than frustration. I don't know about you, but that amazes me. Already in sort of a fragile state, he says, let me just give and give and give. And in his service, he prays. Verse 19 says that he thanks God for the food that he provides for all these people. But I want you to get the feeling that even though Jesus has put it off, by the end of the day, his need to pray is urgent. So verse 22, immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. And when evening came, he was there alone. Here it is. Disciples, go away. crowds, go away. It's time to pray. There's a little bit of leeway in the terms here. But the term evening in verse 23, and then the 3 a.m., the fourth watch of the night, indicates that from some time called evening until 3 a.m., Jesus is praying alone. And the text is extraordinarily clear. Look at verse 23 again. He went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. Extraordinarily clear that Jesus did this all alone. He was by himself, just talking to God. And you know, after that, Jesus is ready for a 3 a.m. walk across the sea. Jesus is ready. Let's talk to Peter. Hey, we got more people over here on the other side. Let's get after it. Jesus is re-energized, ready to go on. So here is what I want you to take from this chapter. Jesus gets through the day by insisting on time alone with his Father. And I want to suggest to you that that's not the only time this happens. Jesus does this with regularity. This is Mark 1 and verse 35. It says, rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. What I love about that story, by the way, in Mark 1, is that the disciples can't find him anywhere. And you know what? They decide, let's go look out on the mountains in the desolate places. He's probably out there praying. It's not the only time Jesus went away from people to be alone with his Father. This is Luke 6 and verse 12. In these days, he went out to the mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose from them 12. So it seems at least likely that something about Jesus' prayer had to do with the fact that he was about to choose the 12 who were going to be his disciples. But isn't it impressive that he spends all night in prayer? This is Jesus' habit. This is who he is. And of course, in Luke 22, in the shadow of the cross, it says he withdrew from them about a stone's throw and knelt down and prayed. And this is the prayer that he repeats the same words three different times about what he's about to face and the cup and how he prays that God's will and not his own be done. It is impressive that he takes three men, Peter, James, and John, with him into the garden, and then it says he withdrew from them about a stone's throw. He wants to be with people, but he doesn't want to be with people, because he wants to be alone with his Father. He wants them to pray, but you guys pray over there, and I'll pray over here, and we will pray together. So Jesus insists on time alone with his Father. He will wake up early to get it. He will stay up late to get it. He will walk extra miles to get it. It does not bother him to be inconvenienced to pray. And Jesus insists on time alone with his Father. Time to send everybody else away, and it's just me and God in a desolate place. This is what Jesus looks forward to. You know, at the end of the day, when the crowds go away, when the work has ended, then this is what putting his feet up looks like for Jesus. I can finally just talk to the Father. This is his food. This is what gives him energy for ministry. I will say it this way. When I have ministry opportunities, opportunities to serve people, they wear me out. Because when you are ministering and serving people, you give and you give and you give. And by the end of the day, you have nothing left. You are wiped out. And so you read about Jesus, and I just keep asking, where does this energy come from? How does he do it? How does he keep going? How do you not look at this person and say, okay, I've had about enough of all the sick people. Really? More crowds? Oh, you guys are still hungry? Wow, whoop-de-doo. How does Jesus never get jaded? This is the secret. He insists on time alone with the Father. How does he always have a lesson for the disciples? How does he always have compassion? How does he just keep coming? Because the energy Jesus has comes from the time he spends with the Father. Now, I know what some of you are thinking, and I just want to head this off at the pass. I know that this raises some questions about, is Jesus, if Jesus is God, how is Jesus relating to the Father? How does that all work? And let me tell you, I don't have the answers for you on that. But I will say it this way. If Jesus needs to pray, I do too. If Jesus needs time alone with the Father, I know I do. If Jesus makes this a priority, how can I not? If Jesus, who is working with a lot more than what I've got, is going to rely on this, then how could I think it would not apply to me? So you think about your days. We have stuff like this, right? We have bad news. We have people who need us. Maybe it's not hungry crowds that we're expected to feed, but there are people who need things from us. Parents, you have people who depend on you, who live with you, who are needing things all the time. When we have a job, we have bosses, we have customers and clients who need us all the time. Need, need, need. When we work together in a local church, we have brothers and sisters, and they need things from us. And so sometimes those needs, those demands, can be overwhelming for us. And so we begin to resent the people who need things from us. Say, can't you just take care of your own stuff for a little while? I just don't have any more energy for this. Could it be that Jesus is teaching us something by his example? This is how you really help people. You become a conduit through which God's power and God's grace can flow. This chapter was a great challenge for me because I had one of these weeks where I started out, I thought, you know what, I'm just going to preach on Matthew 14. It was great. Matthew 14, you got three stories. Three stories make 3 points. Everybody loves 3 points. Stand and sing, we'll all go home. And then I had one of those weeks. You know the weeks where everything falls to pieces. And I was overwhelmed and anxious, working, talking, serving. And what was unique about this to me was that when I get that way, I have certain things I like to do that I think are going to help me feel better. Okay? Usually, they involve lots and lots of eating. I like to go eat and eat a big, really bad for me meal. Sometimes, you know, you read a book, you play a game. Something's going to take my mind off this, then I can relax. But what I found was that it just didn't help. Instead, all I felt was really bad after I ate all that food, or really lazy after I just sat around and did nothing. And so as I read this chapter, this just jumped off the page at me. What did Jesus do? Jesus didn't say, boy, I can't wait to go play on my phone. Get all these people out of here so I can finally have some downtime. Jesus wanted to spend time with God. Maybe I just need to do what Jesus did. Maybe I just need to pray and sit quietly alone with God and tell him about how I'm doing and how I'm feeling and what I need from him. Now, I know when I talk about this, we immediately begin to make excuses and we begin to say, you know what, I would love to do that, but I just don't have the time. I just don't have an opportunity to be alone. Particularly those who are parents of young children. Alone is not an option for me, and I understand. But can we honestly say that we're busier than Jesus was? Didn't Jesus have some demands on his time? And yet, when Jesus made it a priority, when he insisted on time alone, he was able to get it. It seems to me that that's the insistence we need, that maybe what we need to do here is just kind of put aside the other diversions, that we need to silence the phones and we need to turn off the radio. We need to shut ourselves in the closet or maybe in the bathroom or something or somewhere where we can get a little bit of time to spend with God. What Jesus knows and what we tend to forget is that God is the source of strength and healing and peace and compassion and goodness. He is the source. So when we have a little bit of that, we got it from him. And when we run out of that, we need more from him. We will not get through the day the same way without him. So my challenge and my encouragement to all of us this week is find some time, even if it's only a few minutes, to be alone with your Father. Pray. Maybe read something from God's Word and think about what God is teaching or wanting for you. Let's emulate Jesus. Thank you for your attention this morning.